to New York again.
Here tonight, and so whenever there's an election, we have what we call our potpourri night. Potpourri. Oh, I'm using the Passaic pronunciation, and I went in Rome, and we'll be breaking in and out here all evening. It's a very interesting election. A lot of things. Of course, all elections are interesting. No, they really are. Really, it's like kind of a gladiatorial arena. Oh, yeah, people with the thumbs down, boo, 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 and another bunch with their thumbs up. Oh, I mean, not many of us ever walk out, in front of 87 million people and, 67,922,000, give me a little echo chamber in this, Marty, holler, boo, 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 boo. I don't get no echo chamber. Boo, 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 boo. It's not easy to take that kind of stuff. So I've come up with a couple of new, you don't mind, do you? If I keep thinking of rock groups. How about the Dow Jones and the Selected Utilities? How about the Ill-Concealed Animosity? I'm sorry. Miss Liberty and the Wretched Refuse. Send me your... Oh, yes. Well, I'll tell you though, there's a lot of things going on these days, and everywhere you look, there's this fantastic unreported activity that's going on. And the other day, I'm with a friend of mine, see, who's a doctor. Now, doctors are official people in our society. Oh, very, 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 very. And he keeps feeding me information from the medical journals. What's happening in the world of doctors? Are you curious what some doctors are working on? All right, please, if you'll give me a little impressive music, Marty, please. Once again, this concerned radio station brings you another chapter from the annals of medicine. Man's eternal struggle against the great blights of disease, which throughout all ages have occupied men of science. Medical history marches on. Tonight, from one of the medical journals, we read a letter from reader Peter Piyuch of Bethesda, Maryland, who reports that Dr. D.H. Jones, a medical doctor from that area, is a Johnny-come-lately in the unrideable bicycle business. 15 years ago in Elmira, New York, critic Perut says a man in the Bendix Coaster Brake Development Lab built a bike that nobody was ever seen to ride for more than a few yards. The machine fulfilled the definition of a bicycle, quote, a vehicle with two wheels in tandem, a steering handle, a saddle, seat, and pedals by which it is propelled. Unlike medical Dr. Jones, moreover, the Bendix man did the job without the benefit of the computers. The Bendix Unrideable Bicycle, B-U-R-B, had a fixed front wheel, chain-driven by pedals and a sprocket in the normal location. It had a steerable rear wheel linked to the handlebars, which were also in the normal location through a gear and a shaft arrangement on the saddle. B-U-R-B, completely frustrated. All the co-workers for 3 months of lunch hours. They could not stay on it for more than 5 seconds at a time, drive it for more than 3 yards without falling off. And now a medical doctor, Dr. D.H. Jones, has developed ultimately the final unrideable bicycle. We salute him. Now, that's the truth. Imagine working on an did you know that there's a whole cult of people trying to build an unrideable bicycle? Don't ask me why. What an irrelevant question. Because it's there. That's why. What man could conceive of, man desires to achieve. What man can conceive of, man desires to achieve. Pum, pa dum, pum. B-U-R-B. Unrideable bicycles. Well, now, that's taken from a medical journal. You're curious what other medical things are happening? Give me a little more of that fantastic music, please. A little more music. Headline. After long research, it is now discovered. Antibiotics. Slow learning of headless cockroaches. According to latest medical research, it appears that a headless cockroach injected with antisymycin D takes longer to learn to avoid electrical shocks than do headless cockroaches not injected with one of the antibiotics. This fact and its ramifications clearly stimulate the intellects of scientists in the Watch Me Marty in the headless cockroach field. Now, for any of you who have any doubt about the ability of a cockroach to survive under all and any conditions, the reason that they take care, you know, they decapitate cockroaches when they're working on them is because it makes them less active. The experiment goes better when they're quiet. But they're not very quiet when they're headless. It says the roach continues to function very well. He breathes well and everything else. It says, in fact, he can live for weeks, a headless cockroach, until ultimately he gives up because he can't get anything to eat. But that takes a long time. See, a cockroach can live for a long time without eating. And so even without his head, a cockroach is worth thinking about. And, you know, you can't say that about many of us. So, you know, speaking of heads, the other night, I am late at night. See, once in a while, after all the glop has been on television, you know, and everything you've been watching, you know, every night, the half-hour news, and there's a long discussion of who's getting bombed tonight and who's beating up on who tonight and, you know, what the everything is going on. After a while, you begin to think you're living in this fantastic madhouse, you know. Well, which is quite true. And so late at night, on comes on certain, I believe it's Channel 5, I'm not sure. Well, that's all right, they're on the air. We concede that, yes, indeed. Channel Whoopi concedes that they're on. And late at night, on comes the Edgar Kennedy Two Reelers. Well, you know, it's like a breath of sanity in the middle of all the, you know, in the middle of all the glop. For example, did you see the one where Edgar Kennedy is up in the attic? Now, this is a beautiful example of true theater of the absurd. Well, he's up in the attic, see? And it's dark up there. He's looking for something. You know, Edgar Kennedy's the guy with the bald head. He's got this choleric look, you know, like he's a human pimple about to burst, and he's angry, see, all the time. So he's up in the... Yeah, he does. And he's up in the attic, see? Oh, he's looking for whatever it is. And all of a sudden, he sees something in the dark. You know, you never see what it is. He sees it, see? Oh! And he jumps back, and he stands up. And, of course, it's one of these real low attics. With that, he hits his head on the ceiling, but his head goes right through the roof. Pow! Now his head's sticking out of the roof of his house. There he is, see? His head and his shoulders are sticking out. And on the next house is a workman who's working on the drain. See, he's working away in the drain. He sees Edgar Kennedy. You know, he's working away there. He sees him, and he looks at Kennedy looking real mad for a couple of seconds. And then he just keeps on working. See, he's pounding away in the drains, and all of a sudden he says, I don't like people watching me when I work. He continues to hammer away. So we salute Edgar Kennedy. And so tonight we salute one of the little-known artists of the film world, Edgar Kennedy. Here's another one. Did you see the one when Kennedy is sitting by a radio, see? They always have these crazy premises, and they don't explain him. He's sitting there, see? He's sitting by a radio, and the radio is lecturing him on how to cook a chicken. Somehow, did you see that one? Somehow he gets the impression that the subject is how to cure baldness. He thinks they're talking about baldness, see? Which results in him getting up and rolling out a thin sheet of dough and putting it on the top of his head, wrapping it around with two strips of bacon on top. He then sticks his head in the oven. It says, you know, bake it for 2 hours. His boss, who's been watching through the window, rushes in to save him. And we don't have to go on any further. You know, the idea of the two strips of bacon on top just, you know, added a little bit. And did you see the one when Edgar Kennedy takes his family and his wife and everybody out in a rowboat? It opens up in the scene. They're in the lake, see? They're in a rowboat. And actually, it's a rowboat with an outboard motor on the back, see? And they're trying to get it. And Edgar is trying to get the motor going, see? And it keeps stopping. And Edgar goes back to get it going, see? And he falls overboard. Well, as he falls overboard, see, the motor's running. He falls overboard, and as he goes, he grabs at the motor. The motor comes off, and Kennedy has got a hold of the motor, and he goes roaring off across the lake with Kennedy hanging on behind. And his mother-in-law, who is a fantastic shrew, she says, he would go off and leave us. He would. That's just like him. Now what are we going to do? Bah! You see Kennedy going off. I don't mind. You know, it's just that my innate sense of silliness just has to, you know, hello, test. Hello, hello, test. Un, deux, trois. Hello, hello, test. This is WOR, speaking of innate silliness, and we're in the Fun City here. And, oh, it certainly is, I'll tell you. Fun City. Yep, yep. You know, remember when they used to have the Wednesday night fights? Yep, that's right. Well, now they have the Tuesday afternoon fights. And it's funny. When are they going to put them on TV? What an insane world. Incidentally, speaking of the Wednesday night fights, how many of you remember the Wednesday night fights? This is instant trivia right now. Yes, the instant. Well, they were Wednesday night fights on TV, and they came on every week, coast to coast, at 10 o'clock. And they were the biggest thing since Milton Berle. And everybody watched the Wednesday night fights. And you know who was always fighting in them? Joey Giardello. And the Hurricane Tommy Jackson was always fighting in them all the time. And they always were coming from someplace called a cow palace. Is there a cow palace, or did they invent that? There is a cow palace. And they were always coming from the cow palace and little places like Charlie's Roller Rink and, you know, Piscataway Bay, Illinois, places like that. And I'll give you a brass fig-a-gee with Bronze Oakley Pond tonight. I want to hear one listener that rises above the muck and mire of listenerdom who can tell me the name of the bartender on the Wednesday night fights. He was famous all over the country. Yeah, he would come on, and it was sponsored by a beer. What beer was it? That's right. You're correct on a beer. Now, what was the name of the bartender? And while we're on the subject of, you know, groovy drinks, would you please, if you will, Marty, hit the groovy drink button, please?
Good morning. It is dawn. I am speaking to you from a deserted field somewhere in the western United States. As I look around, I can see the men and mechanics of Dr. Pepper waiting anxiously around their trucks. Eddie, Dr. Pepper's most veteran driver, stands near the fire as the kid, his first run before him, turns and says,
Gee, Eddie, I hope there won't be any trouble.
Don't worry, kid.
Dawn is beginning to lighten the eastern sky as everyone waits to hear the final words from the captain before they leave for New York.
Men of the Dr. Pepper Squadron, this is the captain. You have all received your orders. The road ahead will not be easy, but knowing you as I am, I'm confident that despite the pitfalls and misunderstandings each of you shall face, you shall take Dr. Pepper to New York in victory. Nothing can stop us now.
There you have it. The trucks are speeding out with the words of the captain ringing in the ears of every driver. Dr. Pepper's coming to New York, May 18th. Nothing can stop us now.
Yes, once again, the Army marches out. Oh, here's a clue for those of you who are, trying to figure out who the bartender was. Here's a clue. It was not Ethel Merman, contrary to popular opinion. Here's another clue. It was not Ed McMahon. So, did he get it? Of course not. Oh, by the way, to cure all this cause, it was not Jack LaSchooley, because in those days, Jack LaSchooley did all the commercials. They used to alternate between Rex Marshall, Jack LaSchooley, and Dick Stark. You remember Dick Stark? Wasn't it Rex Marshall? Dick Stark. He used to do the Chesterfield commercials. Dick Stark. Yeah. Don't forget now, if you're waiting for the election returns, we'll come on right away. We've got Jack Allen standing by over there in Newark. And anytime we get any dope, we're going to put it right on. By the way, speaking of... speaking of our times, which, we're all part of it. We can't escape it. Do you ever have the feeling that you're beleaguered? Beleaguered. What is beleaguered? Well, there's a lot of descriptions of it. The popular description is, really uptight, man. I mean, everything is falling down around you and you're hanging on. But listen, if you have that feeling ever, you may do it once in a while. Yeah, you get a bill and you say, oh, come on. You listen to the news. Lindsay says he's going to put a 700% tax on everything, and then he's going to tax on the tax and tax on the tax on the tax. And the next thing, he's, oh, no, enough already. And, you dream of opening up a little cave somewhere in Idaho, living in there, selling lemonade or something to the passing tourist and hoping to get out of it all. Well, listen to this guy. I've just brought this in once in a while when I'm sitting at my desk, see, and a whole cloud of blue memos come out of the air conditioning. Yeah, we have blue memos come out of the air conditioning. And they're blue in every possible way. Yeah, they're very disrespectful. Some memos, just absolutely. Listen, one memo said, Shepard, if you use any more blankety-blank language like that blankety-blank show you did last night, I'll blankety-blank you, and man, this is the blankety-blank boss. You listen. Oh, such terrible language. It's just awful. And to a person of such, fine sensibilities, which I have. Yes, I have... I'm thinking of writing an autobiography called The Last Modest Man. And, what's the matter? What's the matter here? I mean, if Mailer can run for God, I can run too. What's the matter? What is it I do? I'm sitting at my desk, see, once in a while, and things are hanging bad. And I can hear the fist fights breaking out on the 23rd floor. You hear them thumping once in a while. See, we're right below them. You hear these thumping, and they're having a sales meeting. And once in a while, you hear some salesman will be carried kicking and screaming out of the office upstairs there. You hear them once in a while. Our sales manager will grab a salesman, and you hear him banging his head on the floor. See, it's just sickening, especially since most of them are bald. You hear this thumping up there. And it bothers me. Especially where I when you see them kicking and screaming and being carried out of the office with their Abercrombie and Fitch leather jackets on and stuff, it kind of makes you think. And so when that happens, when all this happens, I have a clipping which I take out, which I carry with. Is Jack on the phone now? Is he on the phone? Okay. I have a clipping. Now, you ready in there, Marty? Anytime. Oh, he's on there? Ah, good. Now, just a minute now. Oh, gee whiz, that's exciting. Is that the sound of Newark right now? That booming sound? We're getting him here. He's come through. Okay, now I'll be back in a couple of minutes, but we're going to bust right here and go to Newark City Hall for the latest on the Newark elections. And here comes WOR's dynamic Jack Allen.
Thank you, Gene Shepard, and we have the final results now in the...
And thank you, Jack. It was real good. And, it's interesting how Jack, all by himself over there, is out predicting the computers all the time. Thank you, Jack. It was very good. Boy, that's going to be an interesting election, let me tell you. That is going to be a ring day. I'll tell you, that's going to be something to see. June 16th? Is that when the runoff is? Is that what he said in there? June 16th. Boy, oh boy. That's very exciting. And I tell you, they're probably going to be dancing in the street. So thank you, Jack. It was Jack Allen reporting from, I guess it was the City Hall. Yeah, the Newark City Hall, direct from headquarters over there, with the latest on the election return. So it's all over, I guess. All the votes are counted and everything's in. So it looks like, for those of you who might have tuned in 8 seconds late, there will be a complete story on this whole thing at 11 o'clock, the regular 11 o'clock news. No doubt they're compiling all the specifics on it right now. Oh, yeah, Lester Smith's looking dynamic. They're rushing around. And we'll have it on the 11 o'clock news. Sure, you know. You know that I broke in. One of the first things I ever did professionally in radio was an election return. And it was fascinating. I was assigned to a guy. This was in Toledo. I was, you know how they assign reporters to different candidates' headquarters. And I was assigned to one of the funniest guys I ever knew. He was very funny. I never think of you always think of politicians as being these sort of course, the usual cliche is a monolithic type guy. Well, this guy was funny. I'll tell you, he was so funny. And I was assigned to his headquarters, and he was an absolute shoe-in loser. So he could be funny, see? So he was running about, like, ninth in a field of eight. And, everybody, you know the kind of thing where they laugh when you sit down to play the piano? And they laugh even harder when you try to play it? And then finally, when you do play it, they kick you out. You're that bad. Well, which is the way life really works. And so I'm sitting around in this office there, and everyone, and because I was the youngest reporter and the most totally ineffectual one, yes, I was, you know, young. You didn't know what was going on. I was about 12 or something. And, yeah, that's right. And I'm running around there with my little microphone, saying, so, "Oh, sir, God, would you please give us your prediction, sir?" You know, that kind of stuff. When I ever listened to tapes of me made at that time, I get really embarrassed. So I'm running around with this little tape recorder and with the microphone and all that stuff, sitting in this guy's headquarters. And he's got all these salami sandwiches. Well, when we first started out, remember, he's running ninth in a field of eight. So when he started out, he had about nine big plates full of salami sandwiches and about five, maybe eight, ten bottles of Coke. That was the whole party, see. So I'm sitting there eating the salami and drinking the Coke, and there's a couple of other hangers on there, see. And all the ace reporters are assigned to the, you know, to the guys that are supposed to win the election, you see, the official ones, the incumbent, as they refer to them all the time. And so about every 2 hours, they would return it to me for a brief, and they'd say, I would get the thing in the earphone, not more than 10 seconds, because Charlie wants to take it back to the mayor of the City Hall. Now, for crying out loud, don't pad, will you idiot? So I would get it. That was how ineffectual this guy's candidacy was, that they didn't even, you know, want to pick it up. So I had to be down there. So every time it would turn, I'd say, well, there's not much happening here. The candidate is walking around. He's chewing. It's a pastrami sandwich he's got now. And he's drinking a 7-Up. And that's the way it goes here at Charles Dildock's headquarters. And now we return you to Action Central. And the Action Central guy, who was, you see, he was a senior man in our staff. He was 14. He'd say, hello, this is Action Central. Returning back again. See, it was about a 12-watt radio station. Well, anyway, it was fascinating to see what was happening. I was the only reporter down there. We were the only station, you see. Well, about 2 hours into the election, it seems that something funny was going on out there. And my candidate had now risen to eighth place. Instead of being ninth, he's in eighth place. Now he's in last, see, instead of being, below last. Well, all of a sudden there was a dramatic reversal, and he's now, you know, getting thousands of votes. Everybody was mad at all the other candidates, and they didn't know this guy, so they're throwing, says, I'm not going to vote for any of them bums. I'll vote for this guy in the bottom. I never heard of him. So he's getting the votes. Well, all of a sudden, all the reporters started to pile in. And by like an hour before the final election returns were in, everybody's walking around. There's 26,000 guys in my little candidates, and I felt like, you know, I was behind him. See, I thought, gee, he's my candidate. See, and he really was. You know, you get involved in him. See, he's your candidate, and he's giving you these salami sandwiches. He's a groovy guy. Well, He was astounded. I'll never forget how astounded he was. He was winning. He was winning the election. He was really astounded, and his wife was worried. His wife, sitting in the corner by the fern plant, she kept saying, "Now what are you going to do?" You know, she said, "Now what are you going to do?" And what do you think happened? The incumbent conceded defeat. And here I was on the winning side all along. It's like taking get the worst horse in the office pool. You know, some horse that's running with three broken legs and his jockey's arthritic. You know. And the next thing you know, he's going like gangbusters, and you win. Nobody expects it, and I was astounded. And all these reporters are all saying, "Yes, sir," wow. And they're very official. And now they begin to analyze it, see, right there in front of me. And to hear them analyze it, they knew all along, you see, he was going to win. Well, after it was all over, see, and all the reporters, everybody's cheering, and everybody comes, and the flashbulbs are going off, this candidate, I'm still there with my little lonely tape recorder, see, and he comes over to me and he says, "Listen." And I says, "Yes, sir." You know, he won. I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know," he says, "you're the only guy that hung around here all the time." I said, "Yes, sir." I couldn't tell him, you know, that they assigned me here and that was it. He says, "You know," he says, "I'm going to give you an exclusive interview." He says, "Do you want an exclusive?" And I says, "Yes, sir." Well, so I taped this interview. He wouldn't give anybody else an interview. He says, I'll have a comment to make tomorrow. So he was all excited. So I got this giant scoop. Yeah, it was a fantastic victory. Well, I came back to the station, and I had this tape. And so everybody's running around. They're all excited, see. Everybody's knocking themselves out. The Shepherd got this fantastic exclusive tape of the winning candidate. And we rush into the control room, and we put it onto the tape recorder with its big Ampex. And it's blank. Blank. I blew it. I blew it. So I didn't know what to do. You know, I really blew it. So I called the headquarters of this guy's party, you know, which is the headquarters. I said, "Where can I get in touch with him?" I said, "Well, you know, he's very official in communication." I says, "Well, tell him that I called. I was the guy that he gave the interview to." And all of a sudden he's on the phone. He says, "Yeah, what happened?" I says, "The tape is blank." He says, "The tape is blank, for crying out loud." He says, "Wait, I'll send my car over to pick you up." Chauffeur-driven car arrives. He's in now. It arrives. They take me down to City Hall. I interview him, and all these other reporters are looking mad. And from that time on, I've had a strange attitude towards... And by the way, for your, you know, if you're wondering who this was, this candidate, from that little election, went on to become a national figure. He went on to become later the governor of the state, and he became a national figure, and he was at one point even mentioned in the presidential discussions. Well, every time I saw him, I'll never forget. After that, I used to see him very rarely. I would see him like I'd be in a radio station someplace, and he would come up, and he would walk through with 25, 50 guys all around him, you know, guys with the black briefcases, and he'd wade through a whole sea of gay pressmen. See, he'd walk through, no comment, and he would see me. He'd say, "Hey, how are you?" And I'd say, "Hey, listen, anytime you want to share a salami sandwich, I'm ready." He says, "Man, we ought to have a..." And so once in a great while I would see him, and it was always, you know, from that very, very tiny, tiny momentary beginning of being in somebody's room at that sad little hotel. By the way, it was a third-class hotel where his headquarters were. His headquarters were where he and his wife sat. And he went out to win, but it was very funny. And so politics can get to you. It can really get to you. If you're ever around people who the game of it, the excitement of it, the whole showbiz competition, it's like a big, vast, fantastic arena. I remember a couple of nights after Mayor Lindsay was elected, I was sitting over. I had done that night, I believe it was, Merv Griffin show. That's right. I'd done the Merv Griffin show that night. And it was a couple of nights after he was in. And I was just on the Merv Griffin show one night. And I got out. They tape, and they finished taping about 8. And I wanted something to eat, so I went into Sardi's, which is right next door there, where their studio was. So I walk in. And I sat down, and there was a big round table, one of these big center tables they got at Sardi's, and And I was with about seven or eight other people from the show, and I sat down. And we ordered whatever it is that was coming in, and all of a sudden, I was aware of somebody sitting right directly behind me. These tables were quite close together in the restaurant there, and I noticed right at my left elbow, right directly behind me, I turn around, I notice there's a little stir in people where I was looking. You see, I noticed something that was going on behind me. I turn around, and here sitting right next to me is Lindsay, and he's with two or three or four official types, see. So I turn, and I says, gee, you know, Lindsay, and I had known him before. I knew him from the Village and a few other things at the time when I was writing for the Village Voice and all that, and I met him at a couple of parties long before he ran for mayor, and that in, by the way, places like Village Lofts down on 10th Street and stuff. So, yeah, the last time I saw him, he's wearing a black T-shirt, you know, there's been one of these Village parties on it. So I turn, I says, hey. And he looks immediately, you know, guys that are, you know, official, they always think somebody's going to, you know, put the arm on him, please give me a job for my brother-in-law or something. So I turn him and says, hey. I look right at him. And he looks at me. I look at him. I says, hey, I know you from someplace. Remember, it's Lindsay. He says, I know you from someplace. Where was it? I see, you know, you're very familiar. I met you at a party down in the Village. I remember it. Yeah. Oh, he says, that's of course. I remember that. That party. I remember that party. Yeah. He says, what are you doing these days? I said, oh, it doesn't make any difference. He says, well, you know, I'm not knocking around town. What are you doing? I remember he's just been... and he laughed at me. You know, he just laughed like hell. And then he says to me, he says, gee, you know, I says, well, you're mayor now. And he says, yeah. It's really fantastic. And he says, really groovy. Then he turns to the crowd. You know, we're all sitting there. And, you know, he says, gee, it's really great, you know, being mayor. And for that minute, you know, he was laughing it up. And then he turns to the crowd and he says, hey, listen. This was about 2 days after he was in. He says, listen, does anybody at this table want to get married? He says, you know, I'm the mayor. I can marry you. You want to get married? He said, I haven't married anybody yet. I want to, you know, you know, the mayor can marry you. See? He says, anybody at this table want to get married? Well, if you knew the crowd that was at that table, you know, that's the last thing that crowd was thinking of. See, and here was an unparalleled opportunity. You see, to get to get married. And he says, free. He says, free. I won't charge you nothing. See, absolutely free. He says, I want to try it out. He says, I never married anybody yet. And by the way, speaking of marrying people, you know, you know the old myth that you can be married by a ship captain? This is not true. Yeah, that's a myth. It's hung around for a long time, and a lot of guys have used it to their advantage. You know, they take some chick aboard their, you know, their friend Charlie Dildock's boat, and they say, well, you know, Charlie's the captain. He can marry us now, you know. Oh, yeah. Did you know that? See, now you're confused. Now, in international waters, you mean to tell me if I own a 32-foot, you know, rinky-dink cruiser that I can go out 12 miles out in international waters and marry anybody just because I'm captain of this boat? Why not? Because you can't. That's why not. There's a lot of reasons why not. As a matter of fact, if you want to follow that rule, then a captain of a jetliner can marry people. I mean, after all, if you get high enough in the air, you're in international airspace, you know. You think you can. Well, then an astronaut can marry anybody. Right, right. You got this guy. You've been seeing too many Priscilla Lane movies. That's your problem. Who's Priscilla Lane? Well, she shows up late at night, and her shows are always cut up into little pieces with this used car auction sales outfit. It comes out, what are these people doing? Well, they're all here looking for used cars. You know, the whole crowd of looking guys there. But nevertheless, this mythology that goes on. But, you know, I'll tell you, I think I have time enough to tell you this little story here, speaking of stories. I mean, if you think things are going bad for you, don't look so confused, Marty. A lot of people do. You'd be surprised, you know. You live in the cocoon. That's right. Most big companies like, you know, WR, they're kind of cocoons. And you have a tendency to, you know, you're rocked in the cradle of the deep here. And the biggest ripple that ever comes across the stream of, you know, the guys that work in big outfits is whether or not, the shrap lady didn't come yesterday. And so, you know, they had the rottenest, crummiest coffee break. You know, And, that's the biggest issue. You hear them around here arguing whether or not they're going to get Blimpy number 7 or Blimpy number 9, and a big argument will go on for weeks about that. And, that's a major ideological argument. So, you must understand that there are people out there who do feel things are going bad. And for any, like all the guys that own stocks. Stock markets. Oh, boy. I'll tell you, one guy put his head right in the Bendix automatic washer the other day. He just wanted to clean his head out. Not too many bad ideas. Did you read about him in the Newark Ledger? He did. He stuck his head in the Bendix automatic washer because the stock market went down. And, of course, that big paddle hit him on top of the head, and he realized that was more fun than, So, but let me tell you the story. I have a story from Reno. Listen carefully if you think you got it bad. Now, we have one more commercial. We did Dr. Pepper. We did elections. Okay. Reno. Let's give me a little fantastic music. I want to salute a man. This is a special from Reno, Nevada. Are bills getting to you? Do you think you got it tough? Consider Charlie Steen. Remember that name, Charlie Steen. Until a couple of years ago, one of the richest men on earth. Charlie now owes more than $6 million to 300 different creditors. How would you like to owe 6 million bananas? At his peak, Charlie, who will be 50 in a few weeks, was worth in excess of $60 million. He has been in... listen, and you'll know what happened. He's been in bankruptcy court for several months, pacing nervously in the voluptuous main living room of his $1.3 million 35-room Washoe Valley estate near Reno. Steen conceded, and we quote, "It seems impossible that one man could owe as much as $6 million. But it's true. Some people I owe as little as $5. I owe some guys just $5. Then there's the Internal Revenue Service. It claims I owe the government $2.3 million. But I'm not finished yet. I'm going to bounce back." But Steen, balding, bespectacled, and lean, he's 5'9", weighs 130 pounds, admits he's worse off now than if he were broke and had no court appearances to face. The most successful prospector of this century, Steen, in 1952, at the age of 32, triggered the uranium boom. You remember that? Claiming the largest deposit ever unearthed in North America. With a $600 grub stake and a secondhand drill, he struck it rich in the My Vida mine near Moab, Utah. Steen, his wife Minnie Lee, and their four sons lived in a tar paper miner's shack in Cisco, Utah at the time of the discovery. Their home today is hidden in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It has a heated swimming pool, indoor sunken gardens, marble and inlaid teak walls, moat-surrounded dining room, master bedroom, which is larger than most homes. "I'm not about to give up the house," said Steen, pouring coffee to wash down a can of beans, which he ate for his lunch. All he's got are beans. "Hell yes, we're going to bounce back. When I started, all I had was a pocket full of dreams and four barefoot kids." It wasn't long before his discovery that the Steens had their own private fleet of airplanes, a $250,000 yacht. "I was an impulsive buyer," says Steen. "I'd get into a store and I'd buy 2, 3, 4 dozen shirts. I'd buy 12 suits. Now everything I own is wearing out. We used to have $5,000 worth of liquor on hand in the house all the time. Now we don't even have a 7-Up in the house. After everything began to fall apart, I was driven to drinking rot gut. Can you imagine drinking rot gut out of $25 crystal glasses? I finally gave up drinking altogether. And everybody kept advising me, 'Diversify, Charlie, diversify.' So I diversified. I got into things I couldn't even hock. I got spread out so damn thin, everything I touched went sour. I thought I had the best advisors money could buy. I had a top guy that used to be with the IRA, a CPA lawyer to prepare my income tax returns. And now the government says they weren't properly made out. I owe the government $2.3 million for deductions they say I wasn't entitled to. Oh, boy, did I ever make stupid investments.
when I began to diversify. Yeah, diversify. For example, you want to know what, for example? All right, I get into the aircraft business. Everybody says, get into the aircraft business. What did I do? I was manufacturing piston planes for businessmen when jets came in. Oy, that's like making buggy whips when the Model T comes in. There I was. How much did that cost me? $3.5 million, just like that, $3.5 million. So I bought a cattle ranch with 2,500 cows. All I did was walk around and eat. The price of beef went down to new lows in history. How much did I lose on that? I was losing $300,000 a month. A month on that ranch alone. I traded it for an orange grove. What happened? The frost hit. Forget the oranges. I lost $700,000 on that one. And I got to admit, some of my investments were ridiculous. Ridiculous. And here I sit now in this giant house. The bank's holding the mortgage. They're going to foreclose. We're sitting in the middle of all this. Right in the middle of the house. You know what we have to do? They won't let me sit on the furniture because they're going to foreclose. So me and the wife have to live out in the backyard in the tent. The kids. We're right back just before, like, before we struck it rich. I got a lawyer living with me. Answers the phone all the time. Oh, boy. Well, here I sit. $6 million in hock. By the way, these Campbell pork and beans aren't bad. You learn to like them, you know. What I do is eat them with one of my... I got these spoons from Sweden, $12 a piece. Tastes pretty good. So I thought you ought to know, friend. Yeah. And by the way, if anybody walks up, according to the piece here, if anybody walks up to Charlie and suggests that he diversify, he's liable to hit him in the beak. Diversify. I'll diversify you, Mac. You know? Up to the top, but down to the bottom. But he's worse off than being at the bottom. You ain't at the bottom, friends, when you owe $2.3 million to government alone. You are lower than the bottom. You are as working at the core of the earth. Took you 20 years to bore yourself up to the bottom. So hang loose, friends, and don't forget, there's going to be a lot of news about the election on here at WOR. What a ring-ding of a runoff that's going to be. Oh, boy. You know one thing about Charlie, though? Man, he's seen it. He must have seen it. He must have seen it. Don't forget, diversify, think clean thoughts, give him a low silhouette.